So the Bodhisattvas four methods of guidance, which is translated in various ways, like the four elements of a Bodhisattva's social relations is Nishijima Roshi. Thomas Cleary is the four integrative methods of Bodhisattvas. And Edward Conzig says the four means of conversion. And Robert Thurman says the four social practices. Geshe Tsering says the four means of drawing sentient beings to the Dharma. And John Powers says the four means of gathering disciples. And Kokyo says the four Bodhisattva ways of embrace. So we talked about last week that that character that means like to gather, that means to embrace and sustain. And that's in what's used in Chinese here for samgraha, which means to gather. So the way that these practices that a Bodhisattva gathers the Sangha together to practice, and we could say embraces all beings. And these are giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action, as this translation says. And we started talking about giving last week, and came across Suzuki Roshi. Nice reference to giving. Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. The section on God giving. And he quotes from actually this essay Suzuki Roshi does here. But he starts saying, every existence in nature, every existence in the human world, every cultural work that we create is something which was given or is being given to us, relatively speaking. But as everything is originally one, we are, in actuality, giving out everything. Moment after moment, we are creating something, and this is the joy of our life. So everything's being given to us, and we're giving to everything in this larger sphere. This is how it actually is, even though we often don't see it this way. He says, but this I, which is creating and always giving out something, is not the small I, it is the big I. Even though you do not realize the oneness of this big I with everything, when you give something, you feel good, because at that time you feel at one with what you're giving. This is why it feels better to give than to take. And I might even add, we feel one with what we're giving, and maybe we feel like at one with the actual reality of the way things are, which is that everything is being given and being given to us constantly. And in this, you know, inconceivably that vast and kind way. And so when we actually do the little act of like, now I give you something, it feels good, maybe partly because now we're in accord with the reality of everything's being given to everything. When we enact it in just a regular everyday way, we're kind of in accord with that larger truth. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then that feels good, because we're in accord with reality. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And receiving. When you were talking about giving, I said, well, yes, of course it feels better. It does feel good to give. And somebody always has to receive anything that is given. And so many people, I mean, of course, there's so many things given to us we don't even think about in any moment. That aside, just in really receiving.
Like each breath.
Yes, as for instance, each breath, all of those, I mean, everything.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to that, sometimes there's something that you are given that you especially notice.
Yeah.
Sometimes we have a really hard time receiving that. And that's not just me or, you know, a few people I know. That, like, tends to be a lot of people.
Yeah, so...
Do you want to make any comment about that?
Yeah, and Dogen will comment on this too. Mm-hmm. That, like, actually receiving is a kind of giving. Mm-hmm. Because it's this, it's not just a one-way thing. Everything is being given to us, and everything that we're doing is giving back. And where you can't even distinguish so much between which way it's going. So in that way, receiving something wholeheartedly is like just taking part in this larger giving. So I think, so Dogen will say, like, to receive a body and to let go of a body are both giving. So receiving is a kind of giving. Yeah. And I think that in this larger sense of giving. And yeah, sometimes it's harder, actually. And then Dogen, or Suzuki Roshi quotes some of Dogen here about giving the penny or a leaf, a blade of grass. And he says, to provide a ferry boat for people or to make a bridge for people is dana prajna paramita. Actually, to give one line of the teaching may be to make a ferry boat for someone. So to build an actual ferry boat to carry people over is a giving, and then to give one line of, like, well, actually receiving is a kind of giving, could be a ferry boat for someone to cross over also. Usually everyone forgets about zazen. Suzuki Roshi says, everyone forgets about God. So he's actually using the word God here as this activity of everything's being given and received. So it's a beautiful chapter in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind called God Giving. So to continue, well, in the third paragraph here, and he's of Dogen, he says, Buddha said, and this is in the Agamas or the early sutras of the Buddha, when a person who practices giving goes to an assembly, people take notice. You should know that the mind of such a person communicates subtly with others. Therefore, give even a phrase or a verse of the truth, or the Dharma. It will be a wholesome seed for this and other lifetimes. Give your valuables, even a penny or a blade of grass. It will be a wholesome root, or it will sprout a wholesome root for this and other lifetimes. So, just a kind of poetic celebration of giving. Give even a phrase, and this is, you remember, there's these two types of giving that a Sangha brings up. Sometimes there's a third type of giving, fearlessness or protection from fear, but these basic two types are material giving and Dharma giving. And so Dogen's picking up on this, giving a phrase or a verse of Dharma and giving a penny or a blade of grass of material giving. A phrase or a verse of Dharma. And then some of you may have heard these Dogen's comments on the Bodhisattva precepts, which sometimes we recite in the precept renewal ceremony. So in the comments on a disciple of Buddha is not possessive of Dharma or wealth. Sometimes we say it's not possessive of anything, but that in the Chinese it actually says, it brings up these two, it's not possessive of Dharma or material things. And then Dogen's comment is, one phrase, one verse, which is the same line he's using here, to give even one phrase or one verse of Dharma. In this comment on the precept, Dogen says, one phrase, one verse is myriad images and the hundred grasses. One Dharma, one realization is all Buddhas and ancestors. From the beginning, there has been no stinginess. So one phrase or one verse, tiny little bit of Dharma, is myriad images and the hundred grasses. Sometimes hundred grasses is just a poetic way of saying the myriad phenomena. So a tiny little bit of Dharma can be, like Suzuki Roshi says, a ferry boat to cross the shore to freedom. And it's a kind of a nice little section here, I think, in Dogen's essay, where to give a phrase or a verse of Dharma is a wholesome seed for this and future lifetimes. Like it plants this good seed that will grow, and then give your valuables, even a penny or blade of grass, it will be a wholesome root, or it will, it literally says, it will sprout a wholesome root for this and other lifetimes. So kind of like you're planting Dharma giving is planting the seed, and the material giving is like it's starting to sprout. So that's the image. It will, keeps growing and on and on into the future. Yes.
Yeah, just a quick one. We'll see if it is quick. So I noticed that, like, if I'm giving something and there's a thought, I'm going to give this because then this person's going to like me, or I'm going to give this person something because I'm going to try to benefit myself for the future. That feels different.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. And he's kind of, it sounds like he's maybe promoting this merit that will be wholesome seeds for you for the future. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't really say for you necessarily, right?
Yeah.
It could be either one. I mean, I think throughout this he does mention this will be good for you and others. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that maybe could diminish the joy of the giving if we're really wrapped up in how much credit we get for it, or if the person will like us more, because then it's just not as wholehearted a gift. It's like it's more of a trade. Sometimes, is it Michael Newhall? I think somebody in a talk here brought up these three kinds of like mind. There's the thief mind that's always trying to get something for oneself. There's the merchant mind that's everything's a trade and it has to be fair. And then there's the Buddha mind that's just like freely giving. And often we think, well, thief's obviously not so great, but often we fall into this middle kind of merchant mind. Yeah, I'll give you something and I hope I get something in return. But yeah, the Buddha mind is just like, just give to give. And in fact, I think when we are living in that way, the irony is that it is more joyful, actually. And it kind of diminishes our own joy a little when we feel like, I wonder if something comes back. I mean, I think the Dharma is often ironic. Things it's kind of counterintuitive, like completely letting go of everything is kind of receiving everything. But it's hard to trust that because our merchant mind dominates our usual life. The truth, and truth here is translation of Dharma. So you could say the Dharma can turn into valuables. Valuables can turn into Dharma. This is all because the giver is willing. So this is, again, he's playing with these two types of giving, Dharma giving and valuables, material wealth giving. But one can turn into the other because the giver is willing, and that willing is the character for vow or wish, gan. Actually combined with the character for like joyful. So like maybe we'd say could say like all because the giver is joyfully wishing that this be beneficial, or makes the joyful vow of a bodhisattva that this be of benefit. And with that spirit or willingness or vow, then a material gift can become a Dharma gift. And I think that's pretty easy to see how, you know, the way in which you give the material thing kind of like can open up the Dharma or the truth there. And the truth can turn into material, maybe harder to see. The Dharma, maybe we just say that when you're in touch with the Dharma, then maybe naturally from that, then you actually enact a material gift. So they can turn each other into each other. A king, this is apparently some Tang Dynasty emperor, old Chinese story. A king gave his beard as medicine to cure his retainer's disease. You might wonder how that works. And maybe Andrew knows something about...
You do actually use fried human hair as like a blood invigorating herb.
Wow.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
I actually Googled it about, and it, I think it's somewhere burnt hair, like the ashes from burnt hair. And one thing that was on the web was as a kind of poultice for a wound that you put on the exterior and it stops bleeding very quickly.
Wow.
But internally, you would take also?
Yeah, they would put it in a gnarly decoction and drink as a tea. Maybe plug your nose first or something. I haven't tried it yet.
Well, there you go. So, you know, maybe a king with his long, majestic beard would be like, taking part of his body, his regal body, to, like, give to a retainer. Doesn't seem like that big a deal, but maybe for the emperor, that's a big deal, to cut off his whole beard, to burn it, to cure his...
What's a retainer?
What would you say?
Attendant.
Yeah. King's attendant. What's that?
An old faithful servant.
Old servant. Mm-hmm. So someone kind of lower position maybe is the emphasis. And also apparently in the Japanese, the word for cure disease can also mean to harmonize the mind. So it's maybe a little wordplay that a king gave his beard as medicine to harmonize his mind, or to harmonize the mind of the retainer, either case. A child offered sand to Buddha and became King Ashoka in a later birth. And there's apparently this King Ashoka Sutra. Maybe you know if King Ashoka was one of the great Buddhist kings in India, a few hundred years after the Buddha lived, and really like revived the whole welfare system in India based on these Dharma principles, and known as a really great great being that kind of promoted Buddha's teaching throughout India. And according to this old sutra, that in a previous lifetime, there were some kids playing in the sandbox, or I don't know if they had sandboxes, but playing in the sand, and the Buddha came walking along the road. I guess it would be like Shakyamuni Buddha, probably, and with his begging bowl. And one of the kids was just so moved by the dignified appearance of the Buddha, he wanted to make an offering as a little kid, and didn't have any food or anything, but like, oh, let me offer you my play jewels here, maybe, the sand, and put the sand in the Buddha's bowl, and Buddha accepted it, and then made this prediction that because of this child's like generosity and this wholehearted gift, even though it was just sand, he'll be born later as King Ashoka and spread the Dharma everywhere. They were not greedy for reward, but only shared what they could. To launch a boat or ferry boat or build a bridge is an act of giving. This is nice. And Shantideva also mentions those images. May I become a ferry boat or a bridge? And, it's a sort of playing with this idea of crossing over. Paramita means like to cross over to the other shore from samsara, the world of like bondage and entrapment in our habit patterns to the shore of freedom beyond our limited ideas. So that crossing over, you can play with these images of like, how do you cross over to the other shore? Well, you need a bridge or a ferry boat. But then we're also like, you know, actual ferry boats and bridges benefit people too. But maybe because of that that kind of metaphor, there are various stories of some Zen ancestors becoming ferry, having little ferry rafts to carry people to the other shore in a more literal way. If you study giving closely, you see that to accept or receive a body and to give up or let go of a body are both giving. Or literally says both dana paramita. So this is the example of even to receive a body is a kind of giving, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of like to accept this life from our parents or just in a moment-to-moment way is a kind of gift to the world. And it's great to remember this because you could say, well, I'm just like this extra being that's just like taking up resources on this in this world. I don't feel like it's a gift, but no. If you received a body, you are a gift to the world, whatever you're doing. In this big perspective, receiving and to give up, to let go of a body. Making a living and producing things can be no other than giving. All kinds of activities. To leave flowers to the wind, to leave birds to the seasons are also acts of giving. So this is in that really big, big mind again, to let everything be what it is. And a kind of poetic phrase, but to leave flowers to the wind, I kind of, you could say, to let flowers enjoy being blown by the wind, but maybe you could also see it as flowers that are going to be like blown apart by a strong, stormy wind, right? To leave those fragile flower petals, to let them just be blown away. In other words, to let impermanence take its course, to let the birds fly north for the winter when it's time. Or it could be translated as leave birds to their time. So when one comment said, such as leaving owls to the nighttime and roosters to the dawn. Instead of saying, I wish the owl would crow at dawn. Letting things like be in their natural way is a kind of giving. So really we think of giving things to others as kind of like it's the thing that's being given and it's like how it benefits the other is often that's what comes to mind for me when I think about giving. But you could say the actual deeper meaning of giving is for the giver to let go of something. So, and that's the joy of letting go of something. So to let go of a body, to let the flowers fall and the weeds spread. Yeah.
As soon as you've mentioned flowers and the wind, I thought of so many scenes I've seen in nature where the wind blows the seeds from the flowers. Mm. Much further away than the flowers could see themselves if they just fell.
Mm.
So the wind is actually the guidance, the conveyor for the seeds to propagate further.
Yeah.
Possibly, and so it's like the mother of the seeds. In terms of sending it to the
nice point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that the wind actually like gives the spreading of the flowers.
Mm-hmm.
This larger sense of giving as letting go of our kind of control of things, like that they go my way and that they let kind of nature take its course in this larger sense is a beautiful way, I think, to think about giving. It's like letting go and then from that spirit of more like, it's more like just I'm not holding on and then whatever comes out of that that goes to others is just what comes out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then also there's the chain reaction of whatever good we do, then in ways we can never understand gets passed by.
Yeah.
And the good vibrations as well.
Yeah.
So there's a further, I mean, we can never understand it, but that's what happens. Yeah.
We can never understand it, but that's what happens. Yeah. Giving goes on and on. King Ashoka, in that same sutra, was able to offer enough food for hundreds of monks with half a mango. So,
Yeah, that's just what I was thinking too.
I think so.
Patrick, you do have the choice of the loaf or the fish, right?
one note said that, from the sutra, said that at the end of King Ashoka's life, apparently he was quite generous king, especially supporting the Sangha. He'd already given everything from his wealthy kingdom away to the Sangha at the end of his life, and all he had left was half a mango. And he gave that, like, it was, yeah, like the loaves and fishes, and apparently magically supported the Sangha through his intention, right? And this is mentioned in the Tenzo Kyokun, to the instructions to the cook, which Kathy's going to teach this fall. Dogen says, By offering half a mango to a monastery, King Ashoka created wholesome roots as the last act of his life. As a result, he received from Buddha prediction of attaining the way and realized the great fruit. I think this may be like a play on words here, right? The great fruit of Buddhahood, but like the great mango. Even a large offering to Buddha, if insincere, is not as good as a small one, which is sincere. This is the right practice for people. And then Dogen goes on to say, a refined cream soup is not necessarily better than a broth of wild grasses. So this is when he's talking to the cook for the monastery, saying that it's your sincerity. It's not about like fine ingredients. It's like the spirit of wanting to make a great offering, half a mango or a broth. People who practice giving should understand that King Ashoka thus proved or verified the greatness of giving. Not only should you make an effort to give, but also be mindful of every opportunity to give. You are born into this present life because of the merit of giving in the past. So, yeah, from a rebirth point of view, particularly, it's like to be born a human in all the possible realms of beings of which we can only see the human realm and the animal realm, but then there's hungry ghost realms and heavenly realms and hellish realms. And if you just look at, like, start counting the ants in a forest, then it starts to seem like there is a lot of overpopulation of humans in the world, but I think there's more ants. I mean, I haven't counted, it's actually so rare and a precious gift to be born human because of beneficial activity in the past, especially giving. Yes.
So on the Nishijima and Cross translation, is that line is more like we're born with the nature of giving, which is kind of in the spirit of what you said earlier.
Everything is giving. So and to be born at all is to be born into that dance. We can't avoid giving. See, this is Thomas Cleary's translation. Truly, it is because the virtues of giving are inherent in oneself that one has now attained oneself.
Ooh.
Is that the same line? Let's see. Yeah, so that's quite a different feeling, too.
Could you read it again?
Truly, it is because the virtues of giving are inherent in oneself that one has now attained oneself. Mm-hmm. So we could say, because giving is part of who we are, that we become ourselves moment to moment because of giving. Almost like we're like our life is giving our life to our life each moment, something like that. That's how I would hear it. So there's three different versions. You know, this is when you start comparing translations with Dogen, especially. It's like this. Each translation is somewhat limited. Buddha said, if you are to practice giving to yourself, how much more so to your parents, wife, and children. Therefore, you should know that to give to yourself is a part of giving, which kind of goes with what we were just speaking of, right? It's like, because giving is part of our nature, we become ourself. So, but also just in the very practical sense of like, to give a gift to ourself, we might think, it's all about letting go of our own of like taking care of ourselves and giving to others, but let's not limit it to others, because self and others is a little bit arbitrary, actually. So to give to yourself is a part of giving. That's very reassuring. To give to your family is also giving. Even when you give a particle of dust, you should rejoice in your own act because you correctly transmit the merit of all Buddhas and for the first time, practice an act of a bodhisattva, or literally, practice one dharma of a bodhisattva. So a particle of dust, you know, like anything at all. This small act of giving a particle of dust, I just blew a dust particle to some like tiny creature crawling across the floor there. This is like this awesome statement of this is the authentic transmission of the merit of all Buddhas and the practice of the one dharma of a bodhisattva. So the tiniest giving is incredibly wonderful activity. The mind of a sentient being is difficult to change or transform, there's another translation, or turn. And literally, it's this character that means like to turn. The mind of a sentient being is difficult to turn. You should keep on turning or transforming, changing the minds of sentient beings from the first moment that they have one particle to the moment that they attain the way. This should be started by giving. For this reason, giving is the first of the six paramitas. So transforming beings, you could say ourselves, but also others, transforming, changing, turning beings, through giving them a particle of dust to giving them the complete dharma that awakens them to complete Buddhahood. And of course, I think of this transforming beings through giving, I think of the story from Les Miserables. Do you all know the story? Victor Hugo's Les Miserables. Shall I refresh your memory? It's a classic giving story. And actually, Tenshin Roshi brings it up in Being Upright, around the, I think, the stealing precept. So it's, I haven't read it, but I've seen the movie.
Yeah.
It's a musical.
Yeah.
And Jean Valjean, right, is this character who is very poor, and I think when he's young, he steals a loaf of bread just because he's starving. And because of that, he gets put in prison, in this like hard labor prison, for years and years for this one loaf of bread. So he did steal something, but, you know, from the very start, it was like just for his own survival. And I recently read, I think we were talking about on Wednesday night, about the Life You Can Save, this book by Peter Singer. And I think in there he says there's some philosopher, teacher, I can't remember who, said something like, if somebody's really like so poor that they're starving, and they actually steal some food to survive, it's not really stealing. I thought that was interesting. He's like, we shouldn't regard that as stealing if somebody else has plenty.
This is a parenthesis. Any Catholic 7-year-old knows that. That's one of the things that we learn very the thing about stealing. What's not, you know, when you first learn the Ten Commandments and you get to the stealing one, if you're starving to death,
oh,
then it's not really stealing.
Really?
But,
so maybe he was quoting, actually, it probably was. It was, I think it maybe was
anyway,
in St. Augustine
things,
or something.
About how you fudge around the rules. I mean, that's one of the things that we Catholics
mm-hmm.
are really good at. And that's one of the things that we, just in parentheses.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, he, back to the...
That's a nice point, I think. Anyway, so we might say that in that case, he went to the prison for not really stealing. And that's, I think, is part of the feeling of the movie. It's like, wow, this is a little bit unjust that he's there for all these years for this loaf of bread when he was starving. Anyway, he finally gets out of prison, and it's horrible conditions of the, you know, the guard is like totally against him, and he finally gets let out, but he has no resources or anything. And so, and he's just in rags and stuff, so he's immediately hungry again. And I think, I don't remember all the details, but I think he goes into a church and steals some silver plates or something just to get something to eat. And then he gets caught by the police, and they know the plates are from this church somehow, and they drag him into the church, and the priest is there, and they say, we caught the thief with your plates, and here he is, and like, you ready to sentence him to another 20 years in prison? And the priest is like, oh, he didn't steal those, I gave those plates to him. And Jean Valjean is just shocked. But I did steal them, you know. But he's, okay, okay. So they, really? And the police really can't believe it, but no, really, he did. And like, let him stay. Like, get your hands off him and you go away. I'll take care of him. He's my friend. So they let him be. And I think the priest tries to give him even more and gives him a big meal and says, you can stay here now overnight and I'll take care of you in the morning. And he's, Jean Valjean is totally shocked, but he still has some kind of stealing mind. I think he, maybe, I forget if he tries it again, but at some point he, like, through this kindness of this priest just giving and giving with no thought of reward, he's turned. Jean Valjean is like, the mind of a sentient being is transformed through the act of giving. More and more kindness, and he just becomes this completely kind being, and as I recall, like eventually becomes quite wealthy and constantly employing homeless people and giving away his wealth, and he's completely transformed by being given to, by this person who took a chance of, let's give to this person, to this thief. So it's a beautiful bodhisattva story about transforming the minds, of turning the minds of beings. And Dogen says, instructs us to do this. You should keep on changing the minds of sentient beings from the first moment they have one particle to the moment they attain the way. The mind of sentient beings is difficult to turn, and this is how we turn it. Mind is beyond measure. Things given are beyond measure. Moreover, in giving, mind transforms the gift, and the gift transforms mind. So beyond measures, you could say, I think it says beyond great or small, but beyond all our ideas. Sure.
You receive?
I'll receive as a gift. Like, no, you know, I can't ask you to do that. Yes.
Yeah, so I'm recalling a lecture from not too long ago, maybe 1 or 2 months. I forget her name because remembering names is my kryptonite, but she was an older woman with a cane. She did have a brown sash on, and she studied with COVID.
And
could be. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she was talking about there was two different instances. One instance where maybe at an airport or something, someone was asking for money, and Coben gave away everything he had, so he didn't have any money. A different case, though, maybe more than one occurrence.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm transformed.
Sometimes you would see like a little keepsake or something that wasn't his, that he would take for himself. I mean, who's to say like what that means exactly, but it seemed like
that's right. And from someone's house.
Yeah. And I don't know how, you know, the mind is informing that kind of giving.
I think that's what it sounds like, is he's in this bigger space of like, you know, I'm not really holding on to anything and just kind of assuming, well, you're not either, right? And then maybe as a teacher kind of testing that too, right? Yeah. I heard another story. I can't remember who this was, but some Tibetan teacher came to America, from India or Tibet, where it's very poor, and in some city, and it was winter, and he just had his robes, and so he'd go for walks after the teachings, and somebody would give him like a winter jacket, and whatever city this was, he'd see a homeless person kind of like huddle up, and he'd just give them the jacket, and he'd go back cold, and then, you know, the next day someone would do it again, and apparently he gave away quite a few other people's jackets. It's sort of similar, and I thought that was really, apparently true story, and I thought, that's such a radical thing, and, you know, depending on his relationship with those people, and how expensive the jackets were. what an amazing thing! And maybe he could only do it if he didn't have anything himself to give away. But like almost like, well, you gave me this, and I think this person needs it more than me. But wow. Yeah, you know, it's. Again, this book, The Life You Can Save, has been really moving to me to read this kind of philosopher speaking about, there's these agencies in the modern world that will for a few dollars, you can actually maybe like cure someone from blindness or possibly save a life through a vaccination. Things like this in these third world countries where there's millions of people dying all the time. And so he makes the philosophical reasoning, the logic that, if you're, buying a can of soda, you're basically you're responsible for a certain death that you could have prevented with that same money. And so with this kind of logic, it's pretty frightening. And, you know, he gets into various more details about this, but and says, maybe it's not realistic then to, like, you know, how much do we need compared to others really in need? And it's so hard. It's, you know, it really, it touches my heart to contemplate this. And you know, we have to be realistic too. But what is giving really, you know, and what especially if giving is like not holding on, when someone else is in need, and there are always others in need, it's, if we're really open to this realm, I think it's just, it's mind boggling. Very challenging, I think. But Dogen's is sort of getting us into the spirit of giving in general. Mind is beyond measure. Things given are beyond measure. Moreover, in giving, mind transforms the gift, and gift transforms mind. So material gifts may be done with no, you know, particular thought behind it, out of obligation or something. Or it could be like offering sand to the Buddha with this mind of like, I really want to give you something and all I have here is the sand. So mind makes the gift, and gifts transform the mind. It's in interdependent workings of the universe coming to be moment to moment. Everything is transforming everything. And also I think of that, maybe we talked about last week, that emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. that if we see the giver, receiver, and the gift, these three factors interdependent with each other, if you take one of them away, the whole thing doesn't work. You can't have that act of giving without all three of those. You need a receiver, a giver, and a gift. And because they depend on each other, they don't exist independently. Like when Rain handed me this cup, there was like a giver, a receiver, and because of the giver and the receiver, the cup became a gift. But when it was just sitting in the kitchen, it wasn't a gift in that sense, right? It was just a cup sitting there. So it's like it's like the dependent arising of the gift, and therefore the gift is empty of some substantial independent existence as a gift. It's not inherently a gift. It's only a gift when Rain gave it to me. So therefore it's empty of some like fixed gift nature. And same with like I'm a giver, or I'm a receiver because I received the cup from Rain. But actually, that was just at that moment. I'm not a receiver right now, except in some larger sense. So in that way, like those three transform each other: the giver, the receiver, and the gift. Kind of make each other, and mind is involved in creating the all three of them too. So mind transforms a gift, and gift transforms a mind. Yeah, so that's giving. Next bodhisattva way of embrace is kind speech. Should we go on to kind speech? To receive a cough is a giving my experience to all of you and the universe. Like that, it's inconceivably interconnected.
There's a lot of giving going
around. That's why it's better to be a Buddhist. It's a little easier to be giving as a Buddhist.
You can give a cold and receive a cold. Kind speech or loving speech means that when you see sentient beings, you arouse the mind of compassion or compassionate love and offer words of loving care. It's this character, this Chinese character that's pronounced I for love, and it's usually they use the character G for like, is usually translated to translate loving kindness or metta, and I is often gets sort of like a negative rap in Buddhism. It's kind of like attached kind of love, or like a like it's used for like romantic love and maybe affection. So sometimes, you know, from the kind of strict point of view, it's like that's too mushy or something. Maybe the old translators felt. But it's interesting that Dogen uses this word here, and actually, I guess it's in the original translations for this. Kind speech, priya akhyana, is I go, love it, like loving words, and this like affectionate, I think is a nice translation, affectionate. So it's really got this feeling of like, not sort of a abstract kindness, but a really like a warm, affectionate kind of way of speaking. It's contrary to cruel or violent speech, or it's contrary to rude or harsh speech. In the secular world, there's the custom of asking after someone's health, even in ancient Japan and China. How you doing? Or how are you? How's your health? I mean, how are you maybe is like originally the meaning is how's your health? Mental health and physical health, we might say. How are you doing? Sometimes we carry this to excess, I think, in modern culture, where you're walking down the street and some stranger, instead of saying hi, they say, how you doing? And they just keep walking. How's it going, buddy? It's like, do you really want to know how my health is? But the feeling, you know, it's coming from this tradition of caring about how someone is. Yeah. In Buddhism, there's the phrase, please treasure yourself, or please value yourself, or could be like take care. It's this this word, chincho. It means like take care. And in Buddhism, there's this phrase, so kind of in ritual contexts, maybe sometimes it's used. So we don't do this in our shuso ceremony, but as I understand it, and I've seen, like, I haven't seen in Japan, but I've seen videos of the Japanese shuso question and answer dharma inquiry ceremony, right, as many of you have seen, where the shuso has this staff, and we'll have one of them this December. And everyone in the assembly asks a question, and the shuso responds in a very upright and direct fashion. In Japan, it's a bunch of young men, so it's very upright and direct and dramatic. So, like, yelling at the top of their lungs, the videos I've seen, it's really like the questions are like, ah, yeah, yeah. And the shuso, ah. It might not look like loving, kind, affectionate words, but it's, you know, it's a dharma inquiry back and forth, and I think it's expression of great energy But after the exchange, every exchange ends with the questioner says, "Qing Chou," which is this term here. Please treasure yourself, or take care. Like we've exchanged. Now it's kind of like, thank you for your answer. Maybe is the spirit. Qing Chou, and then the Shuso says, "Banzai," and then the next question comes. Maybe we do it with this by saying, "Shuso." Banzai is like, literally means like 10,000 years, but means like long life, or congratulations, long life. Maybe more like in this case, like the questioner is saying, "Take care," and the Shuso is saying, "Blessings and long life to you." Next question. So very this in the Zen monastic ritual manuals, there's this, they're super like dignified and polite ways of doing all these interactions, like tea ceremonies. And we feel it maybe in the Oryoki meals during Sesshin. It's a very dignified way to offer someone a meal and receive a meal. And I think it's beautiful. It's part of the family style of Zen, is this enactment. So Dogen says, in Buddha Dharma, there's this phrase, "Please treasure yourself," and the respectful address to seniors, "May I ask how you are?" And this phrase means, apparently, something like, literally, it's like, "It's not totally clear," or like, "I don't know the details." So like, if a student's coming to a teacher, this is maybe a kind of interpretation to say, "May I ask how you are?" But it's this kind of maybe humble saying of like, "My understanding's not so clear, teacher." Is how they address the teacher is like, maybe the meaning is like, "I'm open to learning something." A very polite way of greeting the elders. "It is kind speech to speak to sentient beings as you would to a baby." Oh, you're kidding me. You don't want to Puppy. Puppy is a puppy. Oh. I think in that very gentle way, like you're never going to be too firm and harsh to a little baby. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I just had a thought here, and you've got the character in front of you, so this could be nothing at all, but maybe it's something. So kind speech, I feel like, yeah, we're quick to assume that it means like nice, speech being nice. But I also think of like being kind, like two things of the same kind. So the guy walking by me saying good morning, I wouldn't like respond by saying applesauce. I'd be like, "Oh, how's it going?"
Uh-huh.
You know, like in kind.
Yeah, I think we could say, it, I mean, literally here, it just means like this loving or affectionate.
Okay.
But in English, that's a nice kind of like word play we could do with it, that meaning like it's in accord with the situation.
Yeah.
It's in accord. Same with giving is like, you're like, you're giving an appropriate gift to the situation, taking into account the whole. Like you don't, it'd be so nice to give little Johnny a machine gun. It's like, that's not really like in kind. It's not kind giving. So yeah, the speech that accords. So maybe if somebody's, we meet people in different moods too. And sometimes very formal like this. But in other cases, that would be maybe obnoxious to be that formal, right?
Yeah.
So there's, it depends on the situation.
Yeah, there's that Louis Armstrong, I think it's Louis Armstrong, so friends shaking hands, saying, "How do you do?" They're really saying,
"I love you."
Right?
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
What it really means, is this intimate connection. Mm-hmm. Totally. praise those with virtue, pity those without it. And we might say, well, isn't that a little condescending to pity those without virtue? We could say maybe that's like those without virtue suffer, right? Those who are not kind, in a way, we can have sympathy for them because so much because they lack virtue, actually, but because they lack virtue, they're not going to be so happy. Mm-hmm. That'd be my take on it.
I would be interested in knowing what the original word was, because I think, as you say,
pity.
The pity may not be the right, a good translation.
Yeah.
Maybe better to say, have compassion on those who do not have virtue, because pity is a loaded word.
It is a loaded word. We often say when we're talking about with compassion, we say that the near enemy of compassion, meaning like the the thing that seems like compassion but that's really not, is pity, because it's separating, it's condescending. I think that it's maybe like not an actual character here, but let's see. Because this Dogen writes the Shobogenzo in Japanese, so he puts in some Chinese phrases, and then a lot of it's hiragana, which is the syllabary language of Japan. Which is not, it means that he's, which was a radical thing in his time, because all the other, like most of the other Zen texts were being written in classical Chinese, because it was like the classic Dharma writing. It would be like maybe Christian things being written in Latin, because it's like the formal way. So Dogen's writing this masterpiece of the Shobogenzo in a kind of colloquial, everyday language that people can understand, which was unusual at that time in the formal Zen world. Praise those with virtue. Yeah, no, it's in hiragana, so I don't understand it.
You'll have to Google it.
But virtue is the Chinese character that Dogen puts in the middle of that sentence that means means virtue, I think is the standard translation. We might say like have sympathy for those without it. But again, I think not so much that because they don't have virtue, which is really cool, but because like if we don't have live virtuously, it's a painful life. If kind speech is offered little by little, virtue will grow. And actually it says, in the original it doesn't say virtue again there. I think it just says it will grow. So it looks like the interpretation here is that it means virtue. But if you just leave it as it will grow, it could mean kind speech will grow. If kind speech is offered little by little, it will grow. Like we practice it a little bit and it'll get easier and easier the more we do it. Thus, even kind speech, which is not ordinarily known or seen, comes into being. You should be willing to practice it for this entire present life. Do not give up, world after world, life after life. Kind speech is the basis for reconciling rulers and subduing enemies.
Yeah,
yeah, and good old NVC, y'all know, nonviolent communication, I think is so effective. Y'all know about nonviolent communication? It's this system of, is it Paul
Rosenberg?
Larry or Paul Rosenberg? John. Somebody Rosenberg. In modern times, came up with this. Marshall! That's it. Marshall Rosenberg. Yeah. Is this system of communicating with these, you know, it's pretty simple guidelines, and then he has these courses and you can do it, and he's brought this into like you know, government situations where there's people really against each other, and you know, he's just an amazing mediator once you know how to do this process. And I find, you know, we did some practice at San Francisco Zen Center. We'd have periodic workshops and this kind of thing. It's hard to remember it sometimes, but the principles are, like, the basic one that I think is just so helpful in conversations is making I statements and, like, saying, and I think it's like, and you structure your sentence. If you have a conflict with somebody and you want to say something, this is my memory of how it works, is say, I feel, and feeling, there's this list of words you can use and list of words you can't use, and and basically you're trying to get to your really direct feeling of how you feel emotionally without it being blaming, which I think is one of the hardest steps in this when I try to do this. Like, I feel, you know, I feel attacked. No? Because, you know, attack implies you're attacking me. That's a blaming word. So sometimes I feel, you know, I feel mistrusted. No? Any word that's like, that's putting the blame onto the other, you don't, you just go directly to your feeling, I feel like actually hurt. That's, you can say, or I feel, you know, I feel like sad, or like, it's quite tricky, but he very skillfully has come up with a lot of words you can use for emotions that aren't blaming. But this is why it takes practice. What's that?
Can you be rejected? Is that a blame thing?
I think so. I think it's implying, yeah. And maybe, you know, when I say hurt, even that's on the edge, right? Because it's like,
even sad.
Well,
if it's, I feel sad because
Well, this is where how it keeps going now. You get to the feeling.
I feel frightened or I feel unsafe.
Yeah, unsafe, I think, is good because it doesn't imply like afraid of you know. But I feel unsafe,
vulnerable.
These are good ones. Yeah.
You
can go on the web.
Yeah,
you can find the whole list of words. But
he has a bunch of videos on YouTube.
Yeah, he's amazing to see him in action too, Marshall Rosenberg. But I feel vulnerable when you said that or did that. So you're talking about the situation, but you're not talking about you in general. Like, I feel hurt. I feel like, you know, attacked by you. When you said such and such, I felt vulnerable because I have the need, or, you know, the basic need for, like, safety. So it's like the I statement, the feeling without blame, the specific situation that you're talking about, and the need that you have. And then you can make a request too. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I request that you not use that word towards me. And, you know, this is my, you know, I haven't looked into this for a while, but my memory of it, it's like, that's the basic principle. And if you train yourself in it, it doesn't have to be so clunky of like, what did I leave out? But the principle, it's amazing to me. Even though the one that I remember most is more like, here's the feeling that I'm owning, Because usually when the conversation is like this, it gets all, it's forgetting about me completely. It's just, you did such an evil, how could you do it? You're so evil. And we're like, I feel. And as soon as you say, I feel, in a difficult conversation, immediately the person, their defenses go down. Because usually when the situation's heated, it's not like I feel vulnerable. It's more like, you're a jerk. So anyway, maybe we'll do, I know there's been workshops here before this NVC.
Nanette has really done lots of
I think it fits very into accord with Buddha Dharma principles, because it's mindfulness of, it's being mindful of oneself. That's maybe one of the main correlations. It's like really be tuning in to mindfulness of feeling. How is this for me now? And when we can express that, it really diffuses a heated thing.
And then you're supposed to be speaking with, you know, or listening with giraffe ears.
Oh, yeah.
Biggest heart of any mammal, and be able to pump all that blood all the way up the neck. I just said that to tie it in with kind and compassion.
Yeah. Not a jackal. Right. Jackal mind.
Well, also it's like it's way above things.
Mm-hmm. And maybe also kind of stretching beyond what we kind of like. I think we're willing to go in this argument.
There's one more. Is there an active listening component where the person responds?
Yeah. Repeating back. Yes, right. Like, I heard you say, da 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 da.
Do you feel when I do?
Yeah. So it's a very active, reconciling. We might say this is an example of like loving or kind words, even though it might not be directly like, oh, I think that's so sweet. It might be like really like emotionally disturbed here, both people. But in a way, it's kind. It's kind to say how we really are.
And then for the other person to acknowledge your pain.
Yeah, when we feel that acknowledgement of our pain, then it really, you say, wow, really? Because often it's just we don't feel heard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Such a big part of these problems. Mm-hmm. So kind speech is the basis for reconciling rulers and subduing enemies. So, any kind of kind speech. So this would maybe in this nonviolent communication context, kind speech would include things like active listening, being honest about how we're feeling, not refraining from blaming or attacking speech.
Taking ownership.
Even in the subtlest way, again, these words, these non-blaming words, like I try to do this with Shoho sometimes if we're in a conversation, or like, I feel, and she'll say, that's still a blaming one.
Oh!
Okay, we got to go online here and find the list. Because I really feel like I can't find one that's not blaming. Maybe any word that ends in an ED, like, something like,
disrespected,
blamed, diminished.
Flabbergasted, that doesn't really work.
Yeah, that may be okay.
Yeah,
if that's a feeling. Confused.
Yeah.
Confused. I think that's okay. Because that's not, But it can be quite subtle, the kind of sense of blaming. And usually the person who's trying to come up with the word might not notice the subtlety, but the person who's you're talking to probably does. That didn't sound so not blaming to me. Those who hear kind speech from you have a delighted expression and a joyful mind. literally says that, like a delighted face and a joyful mind. Those who hear of your kind speech will be deeply touched. In the Japanese phrase, those who hear your kind speech, it will be etched in their liver. Maybe liver meaning like their guts,
yeah.
their heart in a way.
Well, liver has to do with loving kindness in Chinese medicine.
Really?
Oh, wow. Anger, resentment, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that could be it. Mm-hmm. Wow. Hmm. There we go. They will never forget it if it's etched in the liver. You should know that kind speech arises from kind mind, and kind mind from the seed of compassionate mind. So I don't know if he's randomly stringing these together, but if we take it as a kind of cause and effect thing, I think that does kind of work to say compassionate mind is first the mind that that is open to the suffering of others. Right? Compassion is that being open to suffering and wishing those to be free from suffering, in terms of the Buddhist definition of karuna, whereas kind or loving kindness mind is the mind that wishes them to be happy. So you could say first there's we notice the suffering. First there's the mind that's like acknowledges other suffering, and from that seed of the compassionate mind comes the kind mind that's kind of like wants them to be happy. And from the kind mind comes kind speech. Kind of like starts with this, if we're aware of others' suffering and people's sensitivity and vulnerability to suffering, then kind speech is a natural result. You should ponder the fact that kind speech is not just praising the merit of others, it has the power to turn the destiny of the nation. So, huge implications of kind speech. Not just praising the merit of others, it has the power to turn the destiny of the nation, or turn the heavens, would be another translation. There's in Being Upright, I guess it's not speaking of others' faults precept. There's a section on kind speech where Tenzin Roshi quotes that section there. Kind speech can transform the nation. And then he says, an effective antidote to our tendency to speak of others' faults is the practice of praising and rejoicing in their virtues. When we see others' virtues, we should speak of them enthusiastically at the earliest appropriate moment. Rejoicing in the merits of others is extremely beneficial in and of itself. If we have trouble seeing others' virtues, then turning our attention around to contemplate our own shortcomings gives us a different perspective, making it easier for us to see the merits of others. In a fortune cookie I recently got, Confucius says, when I see virtue in another, I vow to emulate it. When I see evil in another, I look at myself. That's a nice one. Huh? And then he quotes the story of the great cellist Pablo Casals. This violinist gave this recital for him, and Casals gave him exuberant and extravagant praise, excitedly pointing out the excellent things that he had done. The musician was actually angry, thinking that he was teasing him ironically about his mediocre performance. Some years later, he again performed for Casals. This time, being more mature and less flustered by the presence of the master, he played really well. Again, Casals exuberantly praised his performance. Then the violinist said, I'd like to bring something up with you, sir. Some years ago, I performed for you and did rather poorly, and you praised me highly. I didn't understand what you were doing. Casals said, didn't you do such and such well? Didn't you do such and such very skillfully? Yes, answered the violinist. Well, I praised the skills that you had, replied Casals. As for the mistakes you made and the things you did not do well, I leave that to fools to criticize. My job is to praise. So, that's one bodhisattva approach. And Dogen maybe at least in this paragraph is promoting, but for those who know Dogen in other places, he can be kind of critical as well. And I think Roshi's got another section in Being Upright here about constructive criticism, and is it possible if somebody's really doing something harmful to point it out? And he says something quite nice, yeah, it is okay. Beneficial criticism, there's a whole section on. And he's bringing up, for example, when we see or hear about Buddhist teachers who seem to be abusing their authority in a way that undermines or misrepresents the Buddhist teaching and practice, what is the appropriate response? How can we bring up our concerns without creating division in the community? We must look deeply into our hearts and see if our concern really is coming from a pure love for the teaching, untainted by a desire to lower anyone's respect for a teacher. Can we question and criticize a teacher or a teaching without looking down on him or it? Can we criticize a teacher in the spirit of utmost respect for all beings? And, for other people too. But that's a nice point, and maybe we could, when Dogen gets into his rants about often other Zen teachers, we could see, well, is he doing this out of utmost respect for the Dharma and maybe even the teacher or not? And, he's not around to ask him, so. But I think it is coming from Dogen's total passion for keeping the authentic Dharma pure and true that he gets into these rants. But maybe sometimes he goes a little over the top. I don't know.
I talked to Reb back in the 80s, I guess, and he said he had a really hard time with Baker and all the things that were going on. Shoes outside the door, that whole thing. And eventually, I guess, he and the board had to fire him. I'm not sure how that all happened. But so he had to, he obviously loved him. There was a lot of good things about Richard Baker, but then...
Yeah.
And then balancing that and working it through, and it took a long time.
Yeah, very difficult to do that in a careful way that isn't just reacting and lashing out with total respect. And more recently, when there are various scandals happening in the Zen world, at a meeting just in this last year with Tenshin Roshi, people were bringing that up of various Zen teachers are writing letters to the larger Zen community, kind of speaking out against certain teachers. And why don't you get involved in this, Reb? And he said something like... my practice isn't advanced enough to be able to critique other teachers in a way that's super loving and kind. I thought that was very humbling to hear.
Yes.
His practice isn't advanced enough. Whose is, right? Yeah, so... great for reflection. Kind speech. It's the power to turn the world. And giving has the power to transform beings. So there's two great practices we can take on for the rest of our life. Giving and kind speech. Two more to go. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.